This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Everybody, welcome to Fruit Loops Season 2, Episode 18. Thank you so much for listening. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that we don't hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are white dudes. No, there are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because, well, the news is racist, allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy. I'm Beth. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to fruitloopspod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294, and we may feature it on a future episode. Also, our website is fruitloopspod.com, our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod, and our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod.
That's right, and if you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App, which you can download to your phone, or you can find online at cash.me/$FruitloopsPod, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page, or if you can't help monetarily, no problem. You can always give us a 5-star review on iTunes, it really does help, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. And be sure to share our podcasts with your friends. So who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today, we're talking about Rodney James Alcala. This is a two-parter, and this is the second part. He is also known as the Dating Game Killer, and Alcala is an American convicted rapist and serial killer. He was convicted of killing 7 women and girls, but his true crime victim count remains unknown and could be much higher.
So, how you doing?
I don't have a whole lot to report today about myself. I'm doing fine, but I just don't have anything exciting going on. But I did want to mention, and here I'll get into some of the background stuff about how we create the podcast. When we do a two-parter, we usually decide to split it up when it just starts getting too long for one episode. So the research has been done and the information is written up. It just got really long, so we split it. So this week, since I didn't have to work on that because it was already done, I did some preliminary research on our next episode, but I also had some extra time to work on some merchandise. So we opened up a TeePublic merch shop, which you can find on our website. And also, I'll put a link in the show notes, or you can just Google Fruit Loops podcast merchandise and it should come up for you.
Very, very exciting stuff. Thank you so much for taking care of that for us, Beth.
Sure.
Thanks to everybody who's been supporting the show up to today. We're really grateful.
Very grateful.
This weekend was just a very chill weekend. Actually, my husband called it Mom Appreciation Weekend.
All right.
I was at my wit's end. And so I always thought that I wasn't a person who enjoyed sleep, mostly because I never got very much of it. And turns out I really like sleep.
Yeah, sleep is good.
Oh my God. Friday night, Saturday night, last night, I slept almost 12 hours each night.
Oh my God.
I feel like a million bucks. So wow. I'm good.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Hey.
Shout out to old lady.
I know. Shout out to good old dude. Pop your horn for old Whitey. So now we are going to get into our listener letters. Let's see what we got in our mailbag.
The angels brought the mail.
Yay. All right. So what do we got, Beth?
So we got a message from Parker on Facebook, just catching up on the latest episode. And I have to say, first, love y'all's podcast. And second, it's great to hear the New Orleans culture is strong and reaches all over. I'm from Louisiana, and I've been to that strip club Wendy mentioned in New Orleans, and she's not lying.
I love that. Keep
it up, because this is my favorite podcast and the only one I religiously listen to. Now that's really awesome. Oh, wow. Thank you so much. Parker.
Thank you. Hip hop air horns to you, Parker.
Yeah.
Woo. Yes.
And then this was from Jermaine on Facebook. I love you, this podcast, okay. And you guys are so funny. But I have to tell you that I have a fever, and the only remedy for it is more hip hop air horn.
Oh, wow.
Rock and roll, girls.
Ooh-wee! Well, guess what we're getting? Dr. Feel Good, here it comes. You deserve it.
Yeah, definitely. And then from Esther on Facebook, she said, oh my God, you ladies took an idea right out of my mind. Sorry about that. I hope it didn't hurt. Just found you today, and I can't wait to binge and join the discussion. So excited. And we're excited too, Esther. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. All right. Well, Kimberly on Facebook, thank you so much, reached out and said, I love this podcast so much. Wendy and Beth, y'all are the shit. Thank you so much. Also, Leah on Facebook said, I love you guys so much. The podcast is awesome. I've binged everything in the last two weeks. Holy, thank you. All right. So now we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to get into the story when we come back. We would like to invite any listeners who have a business to advertise to do it with us. For more information, please email us at fruitloopspod@gmail.com or check out our website at fruitloopspod.com. All right. So, Beth, who are we talking about today?
This is part two of Rodney Alcala, a Mexican-American man who became known as the dating game killer because of his appearance on the TV matchmaking show. Guess what? The Dating Game. While in the middle of his killing spree. Whee!
That is wild.
So if you haven't listened to part one, go on back and listen to that, and we'll be waiting for you right here.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's get into it. We're going to start with the investigation and arrest. We just finished the timeline in part one. So if you're tuning into part two, you finished part one. Let's talk about the investigation and arrest. So hit it, Beth.
Robin Samso was the girl at the beach that rode a bike to ballet class and then disappeared somewhere in between the beach and the ballet class. Witnesses who saw the man approaching girls at the beach that day helped the police create a composite sketch of the man, and police released it to the public. Alcala's former parole officer recognized the face and notified police. And on July 24th, 1979, Rodney James Alcala, an unemployed photographer, was arrested at his mother's Monterey Park home.
Okay. Alcala had made plans to move to Washington State, but had only got as far as renting a storage unit in Seattle and moving his belongings up there. Police learned of the storage unit in Seattle and searched it. There, they found hundreds of pornographic photos of women, girls, and teenage boys. They also found a little silk bag containing jewelry. Among that jewelry was a pair of earrings that Robin Samso's mother recognized as hers.
So between the sketch, Alcala's pattern of conduct, meaning his criminal past, photos taken by Alcala around Huntington Beach at the time of Samso's disappearance, which I assume they found in that storage unit, and the discovery of Samso's earrings, police felt confident that they had their man.
So they got him. So now we're going to get into Alcala's trial. Prosecutor said that Alcala liked toying with his victims, strangling them unconscious, then waiting for them to come to before killing them. He liked to torture, rape, and murder, then steal the victim's earrings. And interestingly, not one of his victims was found with any earrings in their ears.
Yeah. And we really couldn't find a whole lot about that first trial, except for that information. All we know is that on June 20th, 1980, Orange County Superior Court Judge Philip E. Schwab sentenced Alcala to death after he was convicted of Robin Samso's murder. At his sentencing, the relatives of his victims stared down at an expressionless Alcala. "I know where my little Robin is now, and that's in heaven," said Samso's mother, Marianne Connolly. "She never again has to face the defendant because he is the devil's own, and I hope and believe he will rot in hell."
Her sentiments are understandable. Mm-hmm. Then in September 1980, Alcala was convicted of the 1979 rape of a 15-year-old Monique Hoyt and sentenced to 9 years in state prison. And on July 11th, 1980, the Los Angeles County District Attorney Office filed murder, burglary, and sexual assault charges against Alcala in the slaying of Parenteau, a victim we discussed in the last episode.
But on April 15th, 1981, the L.A. District Attorney's Office told a judge that prosecution of Alcala in the Parenteau case could not proceed because a key witness admitted that he had committed perjury in another case.
Which fucking sucks, because this saga of trial for this guy goes on for so much longer than it needs to. Forever.
Yeah.
So here's another bump in the road. So on August 23rd, 1984, the California Supreme Court overturned Alcala's verdict in Samso's murder due to the jury being prejudiced. They felt, by learning of Alcala's past sex crimes, it took 6 years, put him back on trial. And although he did spend that time in jail because of the conviction in Hoyt's rape.
Yeah, so thank goodness he did not get out. He was still in jail.
Yeah.
And his next trial was in 1986, again, for Robin Samso's murder. And on June 20th, 1986, Alcala was again convicted for Samso's murder and again sentenced to death in Orange County Superior Court. And on December 31st, 1992, the California Supreme Court unanimously upheld Alcala's death sentence.
Hey, okay. But on April 2nd, 2001, a federal appellate court overturned Alcala's death sentence in the Samso case, ruling that the Superior Court judge precluded the defense from presenting evidence material to quote-unquote significant issues, in part because the second trial judge did not allow a witness to back up the defense's claim that the park ranger who found Robin Samso's animal-ravaged body in the mountains had been hypnotized by police investigators.
Yeah, and I tried to find a little more information about that, but I didn't see anything about it. What that,
yeah.
Being hypnotized by police investigators, I don't know what that means.
I have no idea what that means.
Yeah. But apparently Dana Crapp, who was the park ranger, what a name. Dana Crapp.
What an unfortunate last name.
Yeah.
Dana Crapp's here. Great.
Yeah. Oh, great. It's the crap.
It's the crap.
So she was the park ranger who found Robin's body and had seen them going up into the bushes. And she was apparently a very problematic witness. She was described by some as being a little bit out there. And she had given different testimony in the different trials.
Uh-oh.
In the first trial, she described seeing a man leading a girl into the bushes at the park. But then at the second trial, she claimed to have amnesia and couldn't remember this incident. So I was wondering if maybe the police tried to hypnotize her to get her to remember or something like that.
Oh, interesting.
But I don't really know. I'm just speculating.
Yeah. And there's a lot of behind the scene, really terrible, shady things that happen before cases go to trial. And even when they're on trial, like trial's a show. Trial, we say in my line of work, it's a performance of what happened. It's not really what happened. So
yeah.
Who knows what they did or said to her and why. Why that turned out to be the way it was. So,
yeah.
Anyway, in 2002, Alcala was forced to provide a DNA sample to authorities. He had fought it for years. The DNA matched DNA from Barcombe and Wickstead, two previous victims. And on June 5th, 2003, the LA County District Attorney's Office filed murder charges against Alcala, alleging that he killed Wickst during a burglary and rape. And in 2004, there were more cases linked to Lamb and Parenteau.
DNA on the post of an earring found in the pouch in Alcala's storage unit was linked to Charlotte Lamb. Furthermore, another link in the Wickstead, Barcombe, and Parenteau murders is that they had all been posed after their murders as if for post-mortem photographs. On September 19th, 2005, additional murder charges are filed against Alcala in connection to the deaths of Barcombe, Wickstead, and Lamb.
Robin's mother said during a press conference during this time that she now recognized that if Alcala had been executed soon after his first death sentence, the other victims' families might never have known who killed them. She said the new charges might allow the families to get, quote unquote, some closure. She said, "I'm saying that strictly to be noble, I'm sure," she said. "I just wish he was gone."
Yeah, I can't blame her.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, in 2010, 31 years after Robin Samso's murder, on January 11th, a third trial was held. Just before the trial, Orange County Senior Deputy District Attorney, wow, that's a mouthful, Matt Murphy.
You nailed it.
Say that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to do that, but you nailed it.
So that guy, he told LA Weekly, the 70s in California was insane as far as treatment of sexual predators. Rodney Alcala is a poster boy for this. It's a total comedy of outrageous stupidity.
I could not agree more. I mean, most of these cases where the killers are very prolific, I mean, this is their playing ground, the 70s. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
The
70s
and 80s when we didn't have these advancements in terms of profiling, investigating DNA, all that stuff. So
yeah, this was the serial killer's heyday for sure.
It really was. It really was. So stay tuned. Fruit Loops will be covering more. during the years he spent incarcerated, Alcala self-published a book called You, The Jury, in which he proclaimed his innocence in the Samso case. He hotly contested the DNA swabs done on prisoners periodically for the police department's evidence bank. Alcala also brought two lawsuits against the California penal system, one for a slip and fall accident, okay, and another for the prison's refusal to provide him with a low-fat menu. All right. Well, prisons need a lot of changes to be made, but I wouldn't start there.
No. what's that loaf that Arpaio used to feed the prisoners?
Oh, bologna sandwiches.
Bologna sandwiches, but there was also some kind of loaf that he served them. It was
this I'm not familiar with.
You don't know about this? Yeah.
I know is the bologna sandwiches and the pink underwear.
Yeah. There's some kind of disgusting loaf that they made that it was like a high calorie loaf of garbage that they fed to the prisoners.
Oh no.
So
so yeah. Like crazy me. I heard the news about the prisoners getting bologna sandwiches, and look, I'm going to be honest. Bologna sandwich is my favorite kind of sandwich. I'm sorry. it is my truth. I can't deny who I am. And so like for a second, I was like, turned my head to the side. Like, is it that bad? Intensity with, and I also love pink. I do love pink underwear.
Yeah. Pink underwear. It was the men that he was trying to shame with the pink underwear. But I don't think it was the bologna sandwiches so much as it, the bologna itself was bad. Like it was going bad.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I mean, look, I'm not pro any prison or jail system. I think they all need to go, and a black woman needs to be in charge of building them back up again. But I just, you know, that was one of the complaints when all those lawsuits were coming at Joe Arpaio from all angles, prisoners dying in his tent cities and in his jails and et cetera, and all the, I mean, his greatest hits is the opposite of greatest hits. But I just kept hearing, how dare they give them bologna sandwiches? And I was like, I'm over here like a bologna sandwich advocate. Like bologna sandwiches are good. So can you guys talk about the other bad stuff? Bologna sandwiches are not that bad. Anyway, I'm being insensitive. Yeah,
I just Googled it and it's called Nutri-Loaf.
Nutri-Loaf. Okay. Yeah. Not interested. That's worthy of a hunger strike.
Yeah. And it says prison loaf is usually bland, perhaps even unpleasant, but prison wardens argue that Nutri-Loaf provides enough nutrition to keep prisoners healthy without requiring utensils.
Oh, okay. You know what? Another thing I was thinking about is, so like Michael Cohen is going to jail, right? But he's not going to the prison that like most regular people are going. He's going to the Martha Stewart prison. Uh-huh. But if more straight Christian white males ended up in prisons like all the ones that the poor people of colors ended up in,
eating Nutri-Loaf and green bologna.
Yeah. There'd be quick reform. There'd be some quick ass reform. I mean, people would be rushing to their congressmen and senators' offices to make some changes.
Yeah.
So anyway.
All right. So how did we get there? Oh, his low fat menu. Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah.
Alcala announced to much surprise that he would be his own lawyer in his third trial, even though now 31 years after Samso's murder, investigators also had concrete evidence against him on four different murders from decades past, thanks to the prison's DNA swabs. The prosecution was able to combine these new murder charges along with Robin Samso in the 2010 trial.
Well, that's a win for the prosecution.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
During the 2010 trial, jurors were in for a bizarre ride, to say the least. Rodney Alcala, acting as his own attorney, asked himself questions, referring to himself as Mr. Alcala in a deep voice, which he would then answer in a regular voice. The peculiar question and answer session continued for 5 hours. Alcala was also allowed to question the witnesses, which must have been excruciating for them. According to Jill Parenteau's friend, Nancy, he held particular animosity towards Robin Samso's mother, which he was not able to hide during his questioning of her. Juries don't like that.
No. So what he told the jury was that he was at Knott's Berry Farm at the time of Samso's murder. He played dumb on the other charges, and he used an Arlo Guthrie song as part of his closing argument. The song was Alice's Restaurant, which was written during the Vietnam War. Alice's Restaurant is a song, but it's also an 18-minute comedy bit, which takes up a full side of a vinyl record. It tells a story about how Arlo Guthrie was arrested for dumping trash, which later leads to him being rejected by the draft board due to his criminal record of littering.
I wasn't familiar with this, but I did hear it during the documentary, and it sounded like garbage, like screaming nonsense. I don't know. Have you heard
it? Oh, yeah, yeah. It was like an old standby when I was... When I was growing up, everybody listened to it. It's really funny.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really funny.
I did not get that impression because I'd never heard of it before. I'd never heard it before, but it just sounded like just nonsense. And
well, that's because they only played like the one part that Alcala played. And as we get into a little bit more, you'll see.
Okay, so you say it's funny.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, as a whole, it's funny. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I guess. See, I should have done more research. I just went with.
Okay,
what I
so
saw
the here's
I
here's never... the ref- here's the refrain.
Okay,
you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant, except in Alice.
Oh, well,
you can
cute.
Get anything you want. At Alice's restaurant, just a walk right in, it's around the back. Just a half a mile to the railroad track. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. So that's the refrain.
I am now at peace. Thank you. I did not get that from the documentary.
He plays a guitar. It's just him singing and playing a guitar. And that's all it is. And he just tells a story, and that's the refrain. It comes back over and over again. And yeah, that's it.
Oh, my. Okay. Well, see, it's good to get different perspectives because I thought it was crazy nonsense. But thank you. Thank you.
You're
no,
welcome.
I didn't know that people like enjoyed it. And it was it sounds pleasant. Look, Beth, you can sing that to me all night. Okay. we don't need to do the rest of the episode. Just keep going.
Yeah, just keep singing.
The part that Alcala played was when Guthrie presented for his physical exam for the draft. He decides to pretend that he is really into killing, which he thinks will get him disqualified. He says things like, I want to kill, I want to eat dead, burnt bodies, veins in my teeth, kill, kill, kill. Yeah, that's what I heard.
That's what you heard,
and
yeah.
Instead of being a waiver for the draft, they exclaim, you're our boy. But what finally gets him to the waiver is the fact that he'd been arrested for littering. Littering.
So yeah.
All right.
So that's why it's funny, see?
Yes, now I get it.
Now you get
it.
Oh
man, I'm so glad we had this talk.
But that like you mentioned, that's the part that he played for the jury talking about how he wants to kill.
Yeah. It sounded crazy.
Yeah, and talking about wanting to kill in kind of heinous ways. So I think what he was attempting to do was insinuate that if the jury gave him the death penalty, that they all would be killers too. But if so, it backfired. I don't think he really cared, though, because he was having a great time.
Oh, you think he was having fun at the trial?
Oh, yeah, he was having a great time.
Yeah. Robert Samso, Robin Samso's brother, walked out of the court when Alcala played that ridiculous ass song. He said that he wanted to wring Alcala's neck, and if he had to listen to any more, he would go nuts. He further said that Alice's Restaurant was his father-in-law's favorite song, ouch, and that it was ruined for him and he never wanted to hear it again. Understandable.
Of the other four murders of Barkum, Wixted, Lamb, and Parenteau, Alcala spent little time on those, simply stating that he didn't remember killing him. The only other witness for the defense, psychologist Richard Rappaport, offered the explanation that Alcala's memory lapse could be equated to his personality disorder. The jury, not surprisingly, found Alcala guilty of the four DNA back charges and also found him guilty of killing Robin Samson.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. A surprise witness at his sentencing was Tali Shapiro. Remember the little 8-year-old girl Alcala had raped and beaten within an inch of her life about 40 years before? Shapiro was there to witness as justice for Robin Samso, who was 12. Jill Barcombe, 18. Georgia Wickstead, 27. Charlotte Lamb, 31. And Jill Parenteau, 21. Had finally been achieved. On March 9th, 2010, the court handed Alcala the death penalty for the third time. How many more times do we need, fool?
In April of 2010, the Huntington Beach Police Department made public 120 of Alcala's photographs in an effort to identify some of the women and determine if any could be additional victims. In the first few weeks, approximately 20 women came forward to identify themselves.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's the first time I heard about this guy. Was when they made those photographs public, 2010.
Yep. Okay. Were you into it? Were you like looking through to see if you knew anybody or?
Well, I did look through them. Yeah. I was pretty sure I wouldn't know anybody because it was a long time ago. You know, I was a kid. So, but I did look at the pictures and I remember seeing 48 Hours or Dateline or one of those shows. I used to watch those all the time. Back in the day.
Oh, yes.
Religiously.
Yes, I am aware that you used to watch those shows all the time.
Religiously.
I'm aware that you've been into this for a while.
A long time.
So then in December 2013, while still on death row in California for the murders of four women and a girl, Alcala pled guilty to the 1971 murder of Cornelia Criley and the 1977 murder of Ellen Hover, both in New York. Now, if you'll recall, Alcala raped and strangled Criley, a 23-year-old TWA flight attendant, inside her Upper East Side apartment in 1971. And 6 years later, he killed Hover, also 23 and living in Manhattan. Her body was found in Westchester County, not far from her family's estate.
New York Supreme Court Judge Bonnie Whitner handed down a sentence of 25 years to life in prison. This kind of case is something I've never experienced and hope to never again. I just want to say I hope these families find some peace and solace for these inexplicably brutal and horrific acts, Whitner said. She then dissolved into tears. As I said, in 30 years, I've never had a case like this. That's pretty
profound.
Yeah, a judge crying.
Yeah, that's pretty poignant. Many in attendance at the sentencing wore stickers bearing the black and white photograph that initially appeared in stories about Crilly's death. Cornelia, always in our hearts, the stickers read. Crilly's sister, Katie Stigall, spoke to the court, using most of her time talking about her sister, who was in her prime and wouldn't hurt anybody. But Stigall also had words for Alcala. She said, Mr. Alcala, I want you to know you broke my parents' hearts, she said. They never really recovered.
Hover's stepsisters declined to appear in court. Instead, prosecutor Alex Spiro read a letter on their behalf. Ellen was a sweet, kind, generous, compassionate, loving, and beautiful young woman. She chose to see the good in everyone she met because she had a huge and open heart, the letter read. Her senseless murder irreparably damaged our family. And it's true, these crimes are not only against the actual victim, but the families become victims too and tear them apart.
Absolutely. We say that in every episode. They're left in the wake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're left in the wake. And normally we talk about most people kill people within their race, but this guy killed anybody and it really didn't matter. And so...
He did not discriminate.
He didn't discriminate, no. But he still left a lot of people in his wake, which is really unfortunate because
it's sad.
Very sad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In 2016, murder charges were filed against Alcala in the cold case murder of a young woman in Wyoming nearly four decades ago. It was one of the photographs of the women found with the personal belongings of Rodney Alcala that helped link him to the 1977 killing of Christine Ruth Thornton.
Police believe Alcala killed 28-year-old Thornton of San Antonio, Texas, during the summer of 1977 and disposed of her body in a remote area northeast of Granger in rural southwest Wyoming. Human remains found by a local rancher in 1982 weren't identified as Thornton's until 2015. Though evidence located at the scene was dilapidated, it was determined that the woman had been a murder victim.
Thornton's sister, who had been searching for her since 1977, when she disappeared, was looking through Alcala's photographs that had been made public in 2013 when she recognized Christine. She contacted authorities and submitted her DNA to a national database for missing and unidentified persons. And in 2015, the DNA was matched to the remains discovered in Wyoming. That's good.
Yeah. Investigators in Sweetwater County determined the photograph of Thornton in Alcala's possession was taken a short distance away from where her remains were found. They say they have also turned up additional evidence in their investigation that links Alcala to Thornton's death.
Former Detective Stephen Mack, who worked on Huntington Beach's 2010 case against Alcala, believes it's highly likely that more of the photographed women were murdered. I have absolutely no doubt that there are other victims, he says. He had a gift of the gab that worked with the girls, explained Mack. I think the average guy, and I consider myself an average guy, okay, you see an attractive girl in a bar and you probably won't talk to her because you think she'll shut you down. Well, he wasn't afraid of talking to anyone. He could talk them into posing for his photographs, and it worked over and over.
His ability to evade convictions has often been attributed to his unusually high IQ, but Mac thinks he just got lucky. I had a conversation with him once, he says, and he's got a high IQ, according to everyone, but I don't think he's as smart as he thinks he is. He wrote a book called You the Jury, and I read it, or tried to, and it made absolutely no sense. It was just a lot of rambling.
So, isn't that sort of what you find with dudes who think that they have high IQs, or people who think they have IQs? Is they just, they never answer the question. They ramble, and evade, obfuscate. I mean, it's almost like politicians.
Yeah.
I guess to a regular person, that might sound intelligent.
Maybe they confuse people and they're like, oh, he must be smart because I don't understand what he's saying when speaking nonsense.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, lawyers do that a lot. Doctors do it a lot. And I don't know if they do it intentionally. Like, look, I know you paid a bunch of money for school and you went to a lot of years of school, but like, this is unnecessary. Like, please just tell me like the basics.
Stop acting like an asshole.
You don't sound any smarter. Stop being an asshole. Stop it. No mas. Other women suspected to have become Alcala victims include 19-year-old Pamela Lamson from San Francisco. She disappeared in 1977 after telling friends she was meeting with a photographer. Police say they have no DNA evidence to go on, but witness descriptions convincingly match Alcala's profile. Likewise, police in Seattle are convinced he was behind the deaths of two teenage girls, Antoinette Whitaker, 13, and Joyce Gaunt, 17, in 1977 and 1978. But again, without sufficient evidence for a conviction, we're kind of stuck.
So,
where are they now? Take it away, Beth.
So, Alcala is now on death row at California State Prison in Corcoran. And in 2010, police released parts of Alcala's portfolio, as we said. They released it to the public to aid in victim identification. And the photos are still available to view. Over the years, a few have stepped forward to reveal their horrifying moment with this predator.
Oh, my. Since releasing the photos, police have released or received hundreds of calls and have looked closely at more than a dozen cold cases across the country. Cynthia Libby, the young smiling girl in photos numbered 111, 185, and 193, can only wonder why she survived her meetings with Alcala and count her blessings that she did. Oh, yes, Ma. Count those blessings.
Yeah.
During a recent interview with the police, a detective put his arm around me and said, quote unquote, "I'm glad you're still with us," she says. "For the first time, I really realized how lucky I was." So now we're going to get into what we think made Mr. Alcala, a.k.a. the dating game killer, snap. So what do you got? What are your thoughts, Beth?
Well, he was a sexual predator. I don't really know much about his early life, so I can only speculate. But he was unusual in that he did not discriminate, as we mentioned. He attacked both women and girls, and he had a collection of pornographic photographs of teenage boys that he took himself. Right. So there may be some male victims out there as well. Many killers have a type, like Bundy, who killed adult women, and he liked women with straight brown hair, parted in the middle. He was very specific about his type. Bundy did kill a 13-year-old girl. But she was his last victim, and that was when he was in Florida after he escaped from prison. And he was kind of on a frenzy. And I don't think he attacked her because she was his type. He attacked her because the opportunity presented itself, and not because he stalked her, which was his usual MO. Anyway, I was reading a study about different types of sexual predators. And they differentiated between what they called child sexual abusers, basically pedophiles, and ordinary rapists. The difference being that pedophiles actually have a sexual preference for children, whereas just plain old rapists don't. But they're not above it, like Bundy. You know, though, if they find the opportunity, but they have a. They don't have a sexual preference for children. They referred to offenders who did not seem to have a type as crossover offenders or indiscriminate offenders, and this is what Alcala appears to be. According to that study, findings indicate that crossover offenders report childhood histories of both violence and heightened sexuality. They were less likely than child sexual abusers to be sexually abused, but they were more likely to report early sexual experiences with peers before age 10, which just blows my mind. Witnessed sexual abuse as a child and to have had more frequent exposure to pornography before age 10. Similar to child sexual abusers, 58% of crossover offenders reported an early onset, that is, before age 11, and high frequency of masturbation. A great majority of crossover offenders, 81%, disclosed engaging in bestiality during childhood, in comparison to fewer child sexual abusers, 59%, and rapists, 30%. Mm-hmm. With respect to childhood violence, both crossover offenders and rapists described childhood experiences consistent with physical and emotional abuse. However, crossover offenders were exposed to domestic violence significantly more than rapists. Results indicated that parental violence and bestiality were strong predictors of crossover offending. And I have to say, I am totally shocked at the amount of bestiality reported. That just,
that's a pretty big number. But I feel more for the young people who feel like they have no choice but to engage in bestiality. A couple of things I wanted to just say in response. So pedophiles, my understanding is pedophiles are attracted to young children sexually. But yes. Pedophiles actually, my understanding is they don't believe that they're hurting children. That they believe that they are engaging in loving acts and relationships with children.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to say was, I think we are doing our children a disservice by removing sex education from schools. Children, I don't know if you remember how your kids were when they were little, but my kids are, you know, younger than 10, and weird things are happening to their body, and some things are feeling certain ways and doing certain things. And I think by not shaming kids for having these, you have an erection. It's okay.
Right. It's normal.
You are
it's totally normal.
It's normal. Yeah. If you want to touch yourself, totally cool. Best to do it in private though.
Right.
You know what? Your vagina, no big deal. You want to mess around with it? Totally cool. It's very special place, very private place, but don't do it in public. You know what I mean? Like
right.
I feel like we just have to have a conversation about how valuable these parts are with young kids, which is really uncomfortable and really difficult. But if we don't, and I think that
the shame really screws with our heads.
It really screws with our heads, and it really leads to this
fucked up shit.
Fuck up wiring in your head. So when older conservative white people are like, it's the pornography in the movies that's making our kids do this stuff. No, it's you not having a conversation with your kid early enough about what his or her body is doing, what it means, and what he or she can do about it, or where she can go if she doesn't know what's going on.
Right.
And obviously that's not you. So the problem is you, not the pornography. That's right. All I'll say. This is just one of my hot button issues. So you can message me in the discussion group. I have lots of feelings about talking to young kids about sexual health. So my dad's a pastor, and I would be in Sunday school, like, you know, like 7 years old, like, but is masturbation really wrong? Like asking these questions of my Sunday school teacher, and they'd be like sweating. and then they'd tell my dad about the fucked up shit I was asking during Sunday school. But I had legitimate questions, and these people wouldn't answer them for me. I don't know. Thank goodness for books and movies, because otherwise I wouldn't have known anything. Nobody talked to me about this stuff. So
yeah, which is pretty common.
We need to just have open conversations, just like we do about race.
Right.
We have to talk about all these really uncomfortable things so we can fix the terrible things that result from not talking about it. So
Right. Anyway,
tangent, but let's have some more conversations, shall we? Even with the littlest among us. Okay. What I think made him snap. Sorry to respond. My response to your response was so long. I'm sorry. I don't want to be disrespectful, but we mentioned in the last episode that his dad left his family for a time, and I think that the trauma of his father leaving, he moved from Mexico to the United States and then back, or he had like a big transition from two nations, which is difficult. Perhaps there was some bullying involved, feelings of abandonment. He was in the military. That did not go so well for him. So I don't know. I'm only guessing, but I think a combination of all those things of rejection and abandonment might have contributed to why he was so messed up in the head.
Yeah. And we really don't know what happened when he did come back to the States with his mom. We really don't know what happened. Did she remarry? Was that person violent? You know, we don't know. We don't know.
That's true. We don't know. Only speculating.
Yeah. The psychologist, when he was in the army, said there was no trauma. But again, he's going on what Alcala is telling him. So, you know, he could have left all that out. Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. So we will never know. But if you guys have any opinions, you know where to get at us.
Yep.
So now, now we're going to get into our takeaways, what we thought of the story. I will say that I believe his arrogance is astounding, like Zodiac killer status. The dude went on TV to find a date and won the date, but he also killed people in between. Yeah, killing people in between. That's crazy. And then the trial was so wild. The fact that he was questioning himself and changing up the voices is goddamn ridiculous. And then he played the crazy ass music at the end of the trial that made him look even more crazy. It's just, and it was like, he thought that would help his case.
Yeah, that's another
Mr. Alcala.
Proof that his IQ wasn't so high.
Nope. So what do you think, Beth?
Using the photographs for investigation purposes, I think is really interesting and similar to what they're doing with the drawings of Samuel Little. Although Alcala was...
Oh, right.
Alcala has definitely been less cooperative than Samuel Little, because Samuel Little actually drew the pictures for him. Yeah. And Alcala's like, I didn't do nothing. I don't know those ladies.
Right.
And I saw him getting compared to Bundy a lot, but in my opinion, he was way worse than Bundy. And I think that a lot of people are fascinated by Bundy because he was one of the first cases that we heard about like this. And he got a lot of media attention. Plus, he spilled the tea, as it were, you watch the Ted Bundy tapes, you know, he was pretending like he was talking about somebody else, but he was talking about himself. And
that's right.
Yeah. And well, he was white too. So there's right. that. Yeah. But my biggest takeaway is that this was all a game to Rodney Alcala. The murders, escaping, hiding in plain sight, all the way down through the three trials and representing himself in the last trial and messing with Robin Samso's mother. Which he seemed to really, really relish.
Enjoy?
Yeah.
Oh.
And his suits against the California penal system. I think manipulation should be his middle name. He was having a great time. Yeah.
Rodney Manipulation Alcala.
Yeah, and I think he would probably love to get some more press and to be able to get another trial or something so he can fuck with people some more.
Well, he needs to come on our show.
I was thinking he should spill the tea like Ted Bundy.
Oh yeah. Oh, like in
a, that
in,
would
like
get a, him a lot of press. Like, yeah,
that would get him a lot of press, and then they could do a whole like series about it.
So spill the tea, Rodney.
Spill the tea, Rodney. I'm thirsty. So now we are going to get into the part of our show where we're talking about how not to get shmurdered. I mean, murdered. So... If you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. But in my mind, this is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's mistakes. Sometimes we have no suggestions for a particular episode and we'll just offer up generic tips.
So my tip is that warn the young women and girls and men in your lives about how predators operate. When I moved to LA to pursue a career in entertainment, people were always like telling me, you're young and you're pretty and people are going to prey on your hopes and dreams. And I thought they were just saying that because they didn't believe in me and like they didn't really think that I would could make it. And so I was like, fuck you guys. You're full of shit. But it's true that like photographers and producers will do this fuck shit and like do pretend auditions and get girls to do and commit to things. God. Harvey Weinstein is one. I was never in a Harvey Weinstein vicinity, but really powerful people in the entertainment industry will do that and take advantage of the fact that you want to be a star and that you are willing, you know, they say you got to do whatever it takes. And so, you know, when you're faced in this situation, like, well, he says he just wants to see my boobs. And then he says he just wants to touch them. So, but it's, I got to do whatever it takes. So, you know what I mean? So
that's awful.
You're not thinking. If you are going to a job, in an audition, you should let people know where you're going. You need to know, let people know what you're auditioning for and who you are auditioning with. You can take a friend with you sometimes, maybe another friend who's, you know, going up for the same role or in the same, you know, another friend, another singer friend or actor friend who might also fit the description, like bring them along with you. So that you have another set of eyes to, and another person to help you. Google the gig and the people that are involved to make sure that they're not a scam. If it is a scam, chances are the internet knows about it. This is another tip, give your kids a code word when it comes to their safety, so that in case someone tries to offer them candy or a ride, if the code word is not uttered by this trash ass person offering them this stuff, then they're not to be trusted. And then the kid knows to go to seek help. Also, have code words when you go out with your girlfriends. If you go someplace together, you all leave together. I just heard today on the news two resources, they're apps for sexual assault victims. One is J Doe, DOE, and Callisto, CALISTO. They are online databases connecting sexual assault victims to lawyers, law enforcement, and information to help them navigate the situation. I think Callisto will even notify the Title IX office on the nearest university campus.
Wow.
And so what's cool about these databases, if there's multiple complaints about one person, the database will be able to capture that.
Oh, wow.
And highlight it, and law enforcement can go and target that individual.
That's
right
really
away.
Cool.
So, yeah, and it's anonymous initially. So you don't have to be worried about like the shame that comes with having to report, you know, being a victim. You know that you will be supported by all the resources that these two databases and apps will be able to provide. So I just wanted to shout those out, J-Doe and Callisto.
Wow, those are great tips. Thanks, Wendy.
Hey, you got it, Beth. Now we're going to get into the part of our show where we talk about serial killer or crime news. So take it away, Beth.
So this is an interesting story. James Hart Stern, who's 54, is the new president of the National Socialist Movement, a group whose members wear uniforms reminiscent of those worn in Nazi Germany, celebrate Adolf Hitler, and organize public rallies across the country. And guess what? He's black.
I'm sorry. Are you serious?
Yes.
This isn't a joke, right?
No, this is not a joke.
Okay.
So it used to be the president was a white guy, white dude named Jeff Shope. And for weeks, the change in power had confounded those who study hate groups and perplexed those within the organization. They had heard nothing from Jeff Shope, the white guy who led the Detroit-based organization for 24 years. But paperwork to set the change in motion was filed in January, but neither man publicly addressed the organizational changes until last Friday.
Okay.
And then in a lengthy statement to his followers, Shope wrote that he had been deceived by Stern, who convinced me that in order to protect our membership from an ongoing lawsuit, I should sign over NSM's presidency to him. So this all happened because Shope's organization is being sued over what happened at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville.
Oh.
Yeah. Shope was complaining about how that was an albatross around his neck. And there are differing accounts as to what exactly happened. Shope says that Stern tricked him. Stern says it was an agreement that they both came to. But in any case, the group has been handed over to Stern, the black dude. And Stern's first move as president was to ask a Virginia judge to find the organization culpable of conspiring to commit violence at the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017.
Oh my God, I have the biggest smile.
They had previously denied all responsibility. Next, he plans to transform the hate group's website, visited by millions of white supremacists each year, into a space for Holocaust history lessons.
Oh my gosh. Oh my God. This is beautiful.
I know.
This man needs a statue right now.
He could use a hip hop air horn.
He could. And guess what? He's gonna get it as soon as my phone cooperates. Oh my God. That is so dope.
So the last part is something that Stern said. He said, "I did the hard and dangerous part," he told the Washington Post. "As a black man, I took over a neo-Nazi group and outsmarted them."
I'm worried about his life, though.
Yeah.
He's got a target on his back for sure. And those we know that those hate groups don't
play. They're pretty violent.
So let's add
Stern
to the prayer list.
For sure.
Yeah. So that he is protected in his work for good and for change and for progressive ideas and equity and all the things. Man, I am, oh my God. I was worried that it was going to be a really sad story when you talked about the KKK. And I was like, well, Black History Month already sucks, so I guess March is going to suck too.
I thought I'd bring a fun story to the table this time instead of a really sad one like I usually do.
Oh, that was so beautiful. Thank you so much. Okay, well, I guess I'm going to come with the sad news. I just wanted to mention this Jessie Carrella story. She was a young Boston woman who went out with her friends on her birthday, and she met a man at the club, and she left with him. She was never seen again. Her body was found in the man that she left with in his trunk. The thing is, though, she has a 2-year-old daughter, and I wanted to shout out the GoFundMe page to help this 2-year-old surviving daughter. And so I'll link it up in the show notes. So don't let me forget that. So it is really sad, but there's a 2-year-old girl who needs community support. And so if you can, are willing, why not donate to this girl's future? Because she no longer has her mama. So,
right.
Sorry to bring the house down. Now we're going to get into our shout out section. This is where we shout out content by people of color, any minorities, LGBTQ, or any true crime goodies. So, looks like I'm first. So I shout out the documentary on HBO. It's called Say Her Name. It's the life and death of Sandra Bland. I don't know if you recall, Sandra Bland was the woman who was pulled over by a Texas Ranger. And he pulled her over for failing to signal a lane change. Then he ordered her to put her cigarette out, told her to stop getting snippy with him, pulled her out of her car physically, handcuffed her, put his knee in her back, arrested her for quote-unquote assaulting a police officer, and then she was found hanged in her cell by a garbage bag. The documentary will make you very angry, but hopefully it also ignite the social justice warrior in you because that should have never happened. Mm-hmm. And it happens. It's not like she was the first or she was the last. So the other thing I wanted to shout out is we got a lovely Facebook friend, Val, recommended Thunder Bay. I started listening to it last night and I haven't been able to stop. It's an excellent podcast about the murders of Indigenous youth in Canada. It is wild. What's crazy is it's getting crazier and crazier to me that white people, especially in Canada, I don't know why Canada is so behind on the racism tip, but they refuse to see racism or hate crimes for what they are. I mean, I'm listening to the white people being interviewed and they're like, "It sounds like some Indians were just hanging out, drinking too much, and they got killed.
I don't know. I don't think it was racism. I just think that it was just they got killed. Like, sir, it definitely was racism. So for whatever the reason these youths were killed, given Thunder Bay is apparently it's the most dangerous place in the country for Indigenous people.
Wow.
And that's a very impressive statement. You can't ignore that. So nobody is doing anything about it. So I'm really glad that this podcast is shedding light on the Indigenous peoples of Canada, the tragedies that are occurring to them. And we all know that throughout Canada and United States, Indigenous peoples, especially Indigenous women, have been disappearing, and nobody is saying anything about it. Nobody is doing anything about it. And maybe this podcast will be just salty enough that it will get people to move. So, and there needs to be podcasts about this, about what's going on to the Indigenous women in the United States as well. It's not just happening in Canada. So anyway, just wanted to shout that out. It's good stuff.
All right. So I have a recommendation for related to this episode. There's a podcast called Routing Out, R-O-U-T-I-N-G, Routing Out. I found two different channels, and I think it's the same podcast, but the episodes are old. The ones I'm recommending are actually from 2013. But in these episodes, the host interviews a friend of Jill Parenteau's, who was one of the victims of Rodney Alcala. Her name's Nancy. They had been friends since grade school, and she talks about growing up in the 60s and the 70s, Jill's murder, and Alcala's multiple trials from her perspective. The first episode in a series of six episodes is called Revenge of the Ridiculousness, Healing Through the Absurd. So if you're interested in that, I suggest you listen to those. They were really good.
Okay, we'll link it up in the show notes. Don't
worry. Yeah. And then also I'm going to shout out Preet Bharara's podcast again. Stay tuned with Preet.
Hey!
But specifically his latest episode from February 28th, he talks about the Michael Cohen testimony for a good while. And then he interviews Brian Stevenson.
We've talked about Brian Stevenson before on this podcast. He specifically defends people on death row.
Right. I was going to say he's a civil rights attorney who represents prisoners on death row. But you were ahead of me there. So
Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. So his Equal Justice Initiative is a nonprofit law firm based in Alabama and is dedicated to challenging racial injustice and ending mass incarceration. And it was a really good episode, so I wanted to shout that out.
Thank you so much. I am going to listen to it probably tonight while I'm brushing my teeth.
All right.
I'll be brushing my teeth for a whole 60 minutes. So where can the people find us, Beth?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod. And our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. And links to our sources will be in our footnotes. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App, which you can download to your phone. Or you can find online at cash.me/$FruitLoopsPod, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help.
That's right. Now, this is a weekly podcast, and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, guys. It's crazy out there.